Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's stay-at-home order with its ban on non-essential businesses will continue for four more weeks. Governor Mike DeWine said on Thursday that the extension is painful but necessary as hospitals brace for the surge.
I'm convinced that what we're doing is saving lives. I know it's saving lives. All the evidence shows it's saving lives. We're doing well, but we gotta keep this monster down. He's not dead. He's very much alive, and we're seeing our fellow citizens who die every day.
At least 81 Ohioans have died from COVID-19. As of Thursday, the state has identified more than 2,900 cases. That's compared to when the first cases were reported on March 9th. Today, we're opening the phone lines to tackle your coronavirus questions. Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff is the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Ohio Health. Welcome to the show, Dr. Vanderhoff.
Well, good morning. Thank you. Happy to be here.
What does it look like from where you sit as far as bracing for this surge?
Well, I think that from the perspective of our hospitals and our healthcare providers, we're in the lull that we completely expected. We have been planning and preparing. We have curtailed an awful lot of our normal healthcare activity, the surgeries and procedures that are elective that we've been able to postpone. And all of that has been to help us be in a position to be ready as we anticipate the surge. So things are quiet right now. If you were to go to our hospitals, not just Ohio Health hospitals, but all the hospitals across our region, you'd see the parking lots are not full the way they usually are. You'd find the emergency rooms are quieter, but that's what we expected. So we're viewing this as our time to really get ourselves ready.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Ohio Health. If you have a question about COVID-19, about the coronavirus, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we'll try to get to every single question today, so don't wait. Again, the number is 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As far as the hospital is concerned, how do you know when the surge hits?
You know, that's a really good question. Not only have we never been through this kind of epidemic, the truth is that no community in the world before they encounter it have been through the epidemic, and it looks different in every part of the world that it hits. So right now we have modeling and we have methods for estimating what we expect will happen, but really we'll know that it has hit when we begin to see the total number of cases in our community and the total number of cases in our hospitals hit a certain number and start going down. So we really won't know we got there until we get there.
And until it's over with, but it could take weeks after
the peak, right? That's right. And right now our estimates are that we're looking toward the end of this month as the time when we'll likely get near that peak. Now, whether it'll be a little sooner, a little bit later, we can't say for sure, but we are fairly confident that we should see that peak over the coming weeks.
The feeling, you mentioned the lull, it kind of reminded me of that book by Neville Shute, On the Beach, where they're waiting for the fallout from a nuclear war to roll around the world until it hits the beaches of Australia. And it does sort of feel like that. These days, it's an appropriate use of the word surreal in a way, right?
Yeah, you know, it really is surreal, and I think that that's really a good analogy or a good reference. But you know, the difference here is that this is something that while We've done all we can to limit its impact. It's an impact that our community has gotten itself ready for. Our healthcare systems are all working together in concert with public health authorities, et cetera. We're ready. We're cautiously optimistic that all the pain that we're suffering with stay at home, with businesses being shut down, et cetera, is going to be rewarded with less of an impact in our community and therefore making it possible for our hospital systems to really be able to care for the people who do get very sick. But let's not forget that most of us who get COVID, we're going to have mild, moderate illness with this. We're going to get it, we're going to get over it, and we're never going to need to go to the hospital.
But that's part of the tricky part about COVID, isn't it? That it yeah. kind of lulls it. So we don't get that sick, so we're wondering what's the big deal, and we move about.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's an important thing for us to recognize. You know, the best thing that could happen to us as a community is that all these efforts that we put in were overplanning and overkill. That won't be a bad thing at all. That's a victory. If we get into May and look and say, wow, you know, wasn't too bad. And we all this excess planning that the hospitals did and the plans that we did to even potentially open a novel, a new hospital at the convention center, we didn't need any of that. That would just be a wonderful victory. But we can't plan that way. Mm-hmm. We can't not prepare for what we know could happen. So as healthcare providers, as healthcare leaders, as community leaders, we haven't shied away from the challenge, and we're moving ahead with that readiness.
Again, my guest is Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Ohio Health. And let's turn to some callers now. Tina in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Tina.
Hello.
Hi, is it Tina?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, if you have a company where one employee has tested positive and now there are a total of three, and the company is still open, what are the guidelines for that if somebody has tested positive? Because the numbers are constantly going up. Are they supposed to shut down and sanitize, or do they keep their workers still working? This is a big company in Cleveland, Ohio. So how does that work?
Well, I can tell you about the generalities. I can give you an idea of how any organization and the public health authorities in that community look on the positive tests. The specifics around the company are going to be hard for me to answer, but I can give you a general picture. So when a patient who is an outpatient, and this individual sounds like certainly is not in a hospital from your description, goes and has a test in Ohio, that pretty much means that they have been in contact with a physician. The physician has screened them and determined, okay, it's appropriate for them to be tested. They've gone to one of the ambulatory testing sites. They've been tested, and now they're positive. It doesn't just stop there. What all of those positives are then referred to the local public health authorities, who will ask that person to go into quarantine, and they will do a contact history with them. They'll determine, okay, who did you interact with and how? And let's not forget, this virus, despite some of the reports that we've heard in some media outlets, is not an airborne virus. It is a droplet virus. I'm going to explain what that is, but it's important because what it means is, if we're maintaining a safe distance from one another, we're roughly 6 feet away from each other, we're not in close contact on a frequent basis with other people, it's very hard for this virus to go from one person to another. What they'll do then is the work to identify who were close contacts.
Dr. Vanderhoff, I hate to interrupt you, but we're losing you. Are you moving around?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you there?
Well, yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me now?
That's much better. Thank you so much.
Oh,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so anyway, so there's a whole process of checking contacts. I'm 100% sure that that happened in the case of that coworker. In terms of the business's response, all the businesses in all our communities have been given guidance, depending on the kind of business they are. If you've got concerns, though, specifically about the safety in your workplace, what I would suggest that you do is contact the supervisors or managers at your workplace. If that is unsatisfactory, you can always call your local public health department and communicate your concerns to them. They will help assure that things are being done appropriately.
Tina, good luck with that. Let us know what happens on a future call-in. I'd like to make sure you're okay. Let's see. Leanna in Sunbury, you're on the air. Hi, Leanna.
Hi. I have a question regarding social distancing. Our family has quarantined with no outside contact whatsoever for 2 weeks. My parents have done the same thing for more than 2 weeks.
Okay.
They're in their late 70s. Is it okay for us to visit them?
Boy, that's a really good question. And it really hinges on that social distancing and that social isolation. I would still advise, though, that you be cautious. Why would I say that? Well, the time may not be quite long enough, especially if your parents, in addition to their age, might have underlying health conditions because of this.
Dr. Vanderhoff, we're losing you again.
Oh, okay. Let me see. I'm not sure if it's where I'm going to move to a different spot.
Technology, you'll love it or leave it.
Yeah. So the incubation period for this virus is about 2 weeks. And what you've described is being isolated for about 2 weeks. But that's right. But, one of the concerns that I would have is people can have this and be asymptomatic or have minimal symptoms, especially if they're children. Children seem to do very, very well in handling this virus. And I'd be inclined to wait perhaps another week or so. And then if you do visit them and you're absolutely confident in your social distancing and social isolation, you still need to stay at least 6 feet away. There can't be any hugging and kissing. Certainly, no sharing of eating or drinking implements, that sort of thing. You want to keep some distance. It's a challenging thing, right? Because we're social creatures, and being isolated is bad for the spirit as well. But this is a time for us to be really, really careful and cautious. So that'd be my advice. Give it another week. And then even if you do cautiously interact, keep some distance between you. Don't get close.
Hopefully it gets warmer out so that people can, do things outside together.
And that would be a great, that's an excellent suggestion. And, getting together, so to speak, out in the backyard or something of that kind, that would be even a safer option.
Leanna, thanks for that call. Anybody else, if you have a question or comment, we're going to get to our calls today. So if you're waiting, please be patient. I will get to you. I'm taking you in the order in which you call, so stand by. My guest is Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff. He's Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Ohio Health. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you hear your question answered while you're waiting, please, hang up and let somebody else call in with a different question because our screener is working hard to get to everything. And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're taking your questions about the coronavirus today. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Ohio Health. The numbers to call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's just head straight to our calls. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hello. Dr. Vanderhoff, what physical exercises can the elderly and at-risk do to reduce their need for ventilators?
That's a really good question. And I tell you, first, any exercise activity that you're going to undertake, first make sure that your physician tells you that it's safe for you to engage in exercise. But generally speaking, the exercise that's going to be most important is going to be aerobic type exercise. So you can have aerobic exercise even if you're not able to get up and walk around very much, because there are activities you can do with your arms. And I encourage people, for example, who find it difficult to get up and walk, to do exercises with canned goods, for example, where you can take canned goods and use your arms to move them about regularly. If you're able to walk, walking is fabulous. Of course, you have to be careful about where you walk and maintaining that social distancing. But if you're outside and can walk on a sidewalk, and when you see someone coming, perhaps wait and let them pass at a good distance, or choose to cross maybe to the other sidewalk. But walking is just a fabulous exercise. The more that we can stay aerobically fit, the better position we're in to be able to weather a storm if we develop a respiratory illness like COVID.
John, thank you for that call. Let's see, Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for your show. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I am a Christian. With all the restrictions, including no gatherings of people in groups of 10 or more, considering that Governor DeWine and Dr. Acton have not yet ordered that all church services be canceled, do churches and their parishioners somehow have a special immunity to the coronavirus? And if not, wouldn't they therefore become super spreaders of the virus in our communities? Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Brad. Dr. Vanderhoff, what about them?
Well, I can tell you that my expertise is not on public policy.
Mm-hmm.
I can share what I have certainly seen happening in our community. And I know that many of our churches and other houses of worship have, in fact, chosen to cancel their services. I know that the congregation I belong to has done that very thing. And that's been pretty extraordinary, especially during what for Christians is the holiest time of the year. And I think that's been a very difficult move for not only our churches, but other houses of worship. Very difficult. That's very much the center point of the religious community's life. But I think it's been a very responsible act, and I think it has been very community-minded. So my observation has been that the religious community here in Central Ohio has been very responsive and has acted very much in line with that you're expressing.
So, Brad, thank you for that call. I'm turning now to John in Lima. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for your program.
You bet.
My question is, at least a week or two ago, I heard of a combination of hydroxychloroquine, an old malaria drug, and zithromycin, Z-Pak,
mm-hmm.
had a success rate well in the 90 percentile of knocking this out. So I guess my question is why are we not hearing more about the usage of these two drugs?
Dr. Vanderhoff?
Yeah. So that was a very, very intriguing report when it first hit the media. And interestingly, looking at the report, the medical report that came out of France, it was actually a case series. That the initial report involved a total of 6 patients. It fell more into the category of what physicians term a case series report, which really just is a reflection of a single physician's experience with treating a group of patients. And the hard thing to know about that small series was, well, was it the combination of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin that was making the difference, or were those folks going to recover anyway? And so it was intriguing, and because it was intriguing, further trials and studies have gotten underway. The fact is, right now, the answer is we don't know. The only way for us to know is to do some of the basic science that will help us answer it. And I'll tell you why it's important for us to wait to get the real scientific answer on all of these many drugs that we're so hopeful about before we rush to using them. In my own career, over the last 30 years, I can't tell you how many times we have had early indications about something that we've gotten on board with and then later learned we were doing exactly the wrong thing. We were actually causing more harm than good. So it's really reinforced for the medical community. We have to rely on science. Even though we want answers yesterday, we've got to take a few months and get these answers right. But there are studies. You're right. That is one of the things we're looking at. It is intriguing. There are a whole host of other intriguing things. The good news is we actually do have some emerging data on some medications that I think we're putting a little more attention on because there is some early data beginning to point towards certain drugs, and hydroxychloroquine alone.
Okay, we're losing you again, Dr. Vanderhoff. So I'm going to say, but we'll
I'm going to stand right in one spot.
Yeah, that's
that
sorry. If you get, make sure you have your knees bent a little bit so you don't keel over.
But,
John and Lima, thanks for that. Dr. Vanderhoff, before we move on to another question, I want to tell people that they're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff. He's Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at OhioHealth. And today we're taking your calls and your questions. You can email us. If the lines are all busy, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can also call us at 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and talk with Dr. Vanderhoff. Before we move on, though, that issue, I think it's pretty key at this point that we let the scientists and the medical community deal with this. Don't try it yourself. If you happen to have some of that lying around, you need to let the scientists do their job.
Oh, that's entirely right. So, for example, and one of the medicines mentioned, hydroxychloroquine and its cousin, chloroquine, these are not benign drugs. They are, I would actually go so far as to say, they have real toxicity. So one has to be very careful about their use.
Okay. Let's see. Dick and Galloway, you're on the air. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I'm here working at my food pantry, and I had a question.
Okay.
What happens to the dead bodies? When somebody dies, how is that being dealt with? I mean, are they sending them to funeral homes? Are funeral directors at risk? Obviously, we're not doing funerals because that would be a large gathering. I was just kind of curious, what happens after a person dies?
Dr. Vanderhoff?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And the way that we handle a person's dead body is not unlike how physicians and other healthcare workers take care of the physical body when the person was sick but alive. Many of the same personal protective equipment precautions that doctors and nurses utilize will be utilized by the funeral home personnel. And the funeral homes have been given very specific guidance regarding care of the body. One of the things, for example, is that we are avoiding delays in the necessary embalming and or if they're going to be cremated, cremation. So good question, but yes, there is very specific guidance and there are ways that our funeral home directors can safely take care of a person's body.
Eli in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Eli.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I have my two-part question. My understanding of flattening the curve is that we want to buy time to build hospital capacity and obtain necessary supplies. So the first part is how long before we reach that goal? And the second part, once we do reach that goal, is that when the state would ease up the staying-at-home orders and restrictions since the virus is still out there? I mean, when is this going to, you know, what is the end game here?
So great question. Let me, it's actually got a couple of answers embedded in it. First, what is the goal? And the goal is exactly as you've described it. Imagine that we did nothing, and you may have seen the governor's press conferences and some of the diagrams that Dr. Acton has shared with people. And if you think about those curves, if we did nothing, we might have a big, big peak, with that peak representing not only a total number of cases, but how many of those cases end up in a hospital ICU. And as we know, we only have so many ICUs and ventilators, not just in the state, but in the world. So we want to do everything we can to blunt that peak, which is exactly what our interventions have done here in Ohio. But one of the things is that it's very possible that the total number of people who are infected, even with a blunted peak, we call that the area under the curve, might be the same. It's just that we're spreading it out a little bit more and making it more possible for the healthcare system to be able to use what they have to be able to provide critical care, the most serious care to the people who will need it. Now, when will we hit that? That was your second question. We ask that every day. We have the smartest people, not only in the state, but across the country, helping us to look at the limited data that is available. Because remember, we've had limited testing. But the one group of people we've been able to test really consistently are those people who end up sick and in the hospital. So we know those numbers really well, and we've been able to compare those using scientific methods to other areas of the world that have gone through this before us. And that leads us to suspect that the target that I described earlier in the broadcast of later this month, maybe the beginning of next, of when we think the peak will hit, that's our best guess right now. We'll keep adjusting that. Once we hit that, we'll have an idea of when we really can begin to move back to life as usual. So it's premature, but I would fully anticipate that over the next couple of weeks, we'll have a better handle, and therefore our policymakers and our governor and Dr. Acton will be in a better position to give us better guidance about, okay, when will we be able to begin moving back towards life as usual?
Eli, thank you for that question. Let's see. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff of Ohio Health. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I recall from several years ago when the use of the hand sanitizers got more common, that there was speculation that it might be a bad thing to do that, and because it would be selecting for resistant bugs. Is that a legitimate concern at all?
Well, I think it's a very legitimate concern or question to ask, but what we've come to understand is a little bit different than what you may be thinking. So let me tell you how we think about the hand sanitizers, especially those alcohol-based products,
What you're referencing, I think, had more to do with some of the concerns that began to develop about antibacterial soap, because sometimes those might leave a residue on the skin that is intended to continue killing off bacteria, and those bacteria could develop a resistance to the agents that they leave behind. That's where the resistance comes in. But good old-fashioned hand washing works and does not create more resistance, because what it does is basically physically remove the material from your skin. And the alcohol products work in a not dissimilar way. They dehydrate or desiccate the virus or the bacteria, killing it. It physically kills it, and there's no resistance that they can develop to that physical killing that happens. So that's kind of the answer there. So no hesitation about hand washing, no hesitation about frequent use of those alcohol hand products.
Bill, great question. Thank you so much. Let's see one more before we take a break, and that's Michael in Columbus. You're on the air, Michael. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to thank both of you for being on the air today and helping us all out with some of the questions that we have in regards to COVID-19. I guess I have a comment slash question. I was down at Riverside Hospital the other day and had to drop my wife off to run a few things in, and I noticed sitting outside looking through the window that a lot of the staff, they didn't have gloves on. They didn't have masks on. They really didn't have any protective gear on, and this is in the main lobby. And then I saw a couple of times where people came outside to walk patients out and push them out in the wheelchair to load them in the car. And on one occasion, I saw a young lady help get an elderly woman into a car and then shake the driver's hand and go back inside. And as I watched her go through, I noticed she didn't wash her hands or anything. So I'm wondering, is that common practice in all the hospitals? And if so, why? My second question that I have is that I work in the construction trades. And on the jobs that I have been on, we are right next to each other, although they're practicing to tell us that we should not be that close. Mm-hmm. But yet they tell us we have to get the jobs done. So I'm wondering, in the future, if they are going to do anything about this on the trade, within the trades, because right now I don't feel like I'm essential. I feel like I'm sacrificial. Hmm. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for that question. Those two questions. First of all, the protocol in the hospitals, Dr. Vanderhoff.
Yeah, so first of all, as it relates to the hospitals, one of the things that we have to remember is when we are just watching or observing from the outside, there may be a whole lot of details we don't know about. So first, what about the personnel who are in the lobby? Well, up until yesterday, we were not asking all of our associates to wear a mask as a mandatory item. And I'll explain why we made a change yesterday on that. What we instead were doing was asking people to observe social distancing, because social distancing is probably the most effective thing that we can do to keep this from spreading, that in combination with good hand hygiene and not touching our faces. So the keeping a distance from each other, what is really the main thing that people who are not engaged in direct patient care would have been instructed to do. What about the nurse, though, bringing someone out to their car? The circumstances there are very important. I don't know what those circumstances were, but in many cases, by the time a patient is today being discharged from the hospital, we very frequently do know their COVID status. It is entirely possible that that was a patient that was known to be COVID negative. The handshaking, we have been discouraging that. That's really hard to break people of a social norm, a social habit that we have all been trained since we were small to engage in. As far as the hand hygiene is concerned, we monitor hand hygiene. This was before COVID ever hit.
very actively, and we have 100% accountability to one another. So before that person was turned into a clinical care environment, I can almost guarantee you their hands got washed. So that would address that. I'm sorry.
And no, that's okay, Dr. Vanderhoff. I was wondering if we could take a break real quick and then come back to the second half of his question about trades people who often have to work pretty close together. If we could come back to that after the break.
Absolutely.
Okay, Michael, stand by. And my guest is Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at OhioHealth. We will try to get to all the questions, so stand by. Be patient. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, still with us to answer your questions about COVID virus, about the coronavirus and COVID-19. Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for OhioHealth. And to get to that second part of Michael from Columbus's question, Dr. Vanderhoff, about people in the trades having to work together, I guess construction trades, it sounds like what he's talking about. A lot of people have mentioned that to me and probably you, as I see these guys out there on buildings, they're working 3 feet apart. What about them?
So, very good question. And I'm going to begin my answer by pointing back towards the hospital environment. If you were to go back with your wife to Riverside Hospital today, one thing that you'd observe is that now all of our associates, all the people who greet you, all of our doctors and nurses, are wearing masks in the hospital. And that's been a change. We've moved from making them available to now mandating those. And the main driver of that is that we're watching this virus move through our community. We're seeing what we believe to be more and more community spread. So it's a normal thing for any business, just like healthcare, to be evolving its approach, especially if the work that is going on is still deemed to be vital for the community to continue. So in the construction environment, I am sure there are times where your work requires you to be closer than 6 feet to your coworkers. That makes perfect sense to me. And you know, what are the safety precautions that can be undertaken? I'd encourage you to communicate with, again, both the supervisors at your office or in your workplace, and or if you have union representatives, talk to them about your concerns. But a simple thing that you could do if you have that concern is think about, could you wear a mask in the workplace? Are there accommodations to how you and your coworkers work that might keep you 6 feet apart?
Losing you again, Dr. Vanderhoff.
I don't understand because I've got.
I know it. It's crazy.
I don't know. I mean, I could try standing outside. I mean, I'll go stand outside and see if that works any better. I'm sorry.
No, don't worry about it. I'll just keep letting you know. So it sounds better now. It comes and goes.
Hopefully, if I stand outside, maybe that will be better.
This is better right now.
Okay. I'm outside.
So. Okay. And it's a nice day out.
It's a nice day, so that worked out great. So anyway, that would be my answer. It's very hard for me to give specific guidance about a specific situation I'm not familiar with.
Michael, good luck with that. And again, let us know how things progress as we continue with these this weekly call-in show about COVID-19 and the coronavirus. Let's see. I'm going to turn to Elizabeth in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I have a question about the lymphatic system and viruses, and I'll ask the doctor to speak to that. But my second part is rebounding or mini trampoline is supposed to help the lymphatic system rid itself of, I guess, unwanted toxins. Has he heard about that? Is that true? Is that helpful, rebounding, jumping on a trampoline? And how long should a person do that?
Well, I'll tell you that it's absolutely true that the lymphatic system is an important part of the immune system and the overall functioning of the immune system. We don't know a lot about how best to treat, that is, try to eliminate COVID from a person's body yet. That's why all the trials are going on with specific agents. And I really cannot comment. I'm not familiar with literature related specifically to your question. What I would actually encourage people to do is engage in those things which generally help promote their health. So eating well, getting plenty of sleep, avoiding avoidable or unnecessary stress. Those are the things that we're taking care of ourselves. However, we best take care of ourselves. That's what we need to be doing right now. This is not the time for people to run the candle at both ends if they can avoid it. This is not the time to be eating poorly, et cetera. Eat well, take care of yourself.
Okay, eat well, get enough exercise, take care of yourself. Elizabeth, thanks for that call. I'm going to turn to Sharon in Plain City. Hi, Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about people with autoimmune disorders. I understand that they have an overactive immune system. Is that protective in this situation, or does it make them more vulnerable?
Generally speaking, any underlying condition that a person has that alters their immune system is one where we'd ask them to take special precautions. And, you know, there are just a host of things that can impact our immune system. But when you know you have a medical condition that has altered your immune system's function, whether it's because you're taking medication or because you actually have a condition, staying isolated is going to be very, very important.
Okay. Staying isolated, if you have an autoimmune disease, that's very important.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Sharon, for that question. I am going to turn to Dennis in Middletown now. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call, sir, to be short with you. And I'm older, 65, but I believe I've had the
I don't think that's old. Go on.
Okay. No. I'm very super healthy, sir. Okay. And I don't get sick. And I mean, I've had all the severe symptoms except for the fever, and I never get a fever. But should I be involved with your research? Should I drive to Columbus? And you know, because I seriously believe I've had it twice. I work in a situation that would, and I have a close friend that's even got a worse situation than mine with being exposed, sir. And I don't need to go any further.
That's okay. Yeah, Dr. Vanderhoof?
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful that you are willing or wanting to engage in a clinical trial. And anytime any of us are given that opportunity, it's something I hope we would give serious consideration to. But I would say that right now the clinical trials that are underway are happening in select research centers around the country and are mostly focused on people who are the sickest and are really, at this stage, not focused on people who might have the illness but aren't sick enough to be in the hospital. And you can understand that. Right now, the main question we have to answer is, what can we do to save the lives of those who are most severely ill? As we learn more, we will then begin doing research on what can we do to help people who are less sick.
Okay.
Quickly.
All right. Dennis, thanks for that call. I'm turning now to Greg in Strongsville. You're on the air. Hi, Greg.
Well, hi. I was trying to get in touch with the governor's office to ask him a question about recycling fabric. Will this ever happen again, or should all fabrics be put in the garbage?
Well, I guess it's a good question for a lot of people out there, Dr. Vanderhoff, who donate clothes to Goodwill. That kind of, we're thinking about, you know, we're cleaning out our closets like everybody else is right now, and thinking about that too. What about that?
Well, this is all, I think, stemming from some of the research that has reported finding viral RNA, that's the genetic code for the virus, still on surfaces after a prolonged period of time. The fact is that this virus does not survive outside of the body for extended periods. Finding the DNA, or in this case, the RNA of the virus in place, of course, that's going to happen. That is true for many organisms, and it doesn't mean the organism is still alive. We're still able to infect. And that is no less true for this virus. So, yes, I think that we are going to be able to recycle fabric. I think right now we are holding off on making proclamations or determinations about what the waiting time is before a fabric can be there could be no concern, but it's not going to be an extended window. So I'd say stay tuned on that. When the dust settles and we get some of the more worrisome issues around the very sick and very ill, there will be guidance that comes out around that.
Okay, Greg, thanks for that call. Well, I think we have an email from a family doctor who asks, why aren't more Ohio Health employees working from home? How are you managing that? What's considered necessary? And are you trying to get more people at home, Dr. Vanderhoff?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think in many respects, we're leading the way on that. Large portions of our workforce now do work from home. Understanding that the largest portion of our workforce can't. The largest portion of our workforce are healthcare workers who are in hospitals and are desperately needed at the bedside, and there they remain. But for example, our administrative headquarters is almost empty. And even as we are looking at our primary care practices, and this comes from a primary care physician, we have been working to support more and more virtual care. More and more our physicians and advanced practice providers interacting with their patients using computers and telephones. And we see that as a very, very important part of our response to the virus. So good question, but we're very much headed in that direction.
Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, sorry about the technical difficulties, but thank you so much for your time. No, I mean, it's just the way it works in this day and age, and we're doing our best. But thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. It was a pleasure to be on, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody for all your great calls. Thanks for your emails. Please be safe out there. The folks that I said check back up with us, please do. Let us know you're doing okay. Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff is a senior vice president and chief medical officer at Ohio Health. He's part of a series of shows we're planning for Fridays to get all your questions, as many of your questions answered as we can in an hour about COVID-19 and the coronavirus. So thanks for participating today. Listen next Friday for another show. Same time, same format. Take care. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.